time for Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. Brought to you by Rikus Baird. And now, here's your host.
Hello, and welcome to Branding Business, brought to you by Rikus Baird. I'm Ryan Rikus, and today's show topic is private equity. Our guest today is Murray Reardon, partner at Reardon, Lewis & Hayden, a prominent private equity firm headquartered in L.A. Murray, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Ryan. It's great to be here.
Well, to begin, maybe you can just give us a little overview and your role at RLH.
Sure. All of us on the RLH team are involved in basically all of the core aspects of the private equity process to varying degrees. The kinds of things that we do every day are build relationships with potential deal referral sources, evaluate prospective investments, separate the great opportunities from the others, try to find fair terms on which all the parties can agree for RLH to make an investment in a business, complete the investment, work with the management team to help build the company for a number of years, and then hopefully, ultimately, sell the company in order to create financial rewards for the management team and for our investors. And so throughout that entire continuum, all of us are engaged in most pieces of that over time.
And how long have you been doing this?
I've been a partner with RLH for almost 14 years now.
Well, that's great. Well, I know the firm was founded by some very prominent names in Southern California, including Richard Reardon, a past mayor of Los Angeles, and also Rhodes Scholar and NFL quarterback Pat Hayden. And the business, I know, is celebrating your 25th anniversary. But my question is, have the fundamentals of investing in companies changed over that time, or are they still all the same?
That's a great question. Our core philosophy has really remained the same. We build businesses. That's what it comes down to in three words. You know, you talk about branding and getting the message concise. That's the shortest version. And the way we've been going about creating value for our investors for the last 25 plus years has really largely stayed the same. We help companies sell more solutions to their customers and develop their business so it becomes more valuable. We are not in financial engineering. We're not using high levels of debt on our portfolio companies. We're building businesses the old-fashioned way. And the criteria that we've been looking for have largely stayed the same. The sizes of the businesses have gotten larger as our pools of capital have grown, but we have consistently looked for companies that have a history of profitable growth, have a differentiated solution, strong management, and the potential to be market leaders. And those criteria have always been what we've done, and there continue to be promising companies meeting those elements now just as there were 25 years ago. And so even though our target companies are a little larger now and our industry focus has probably gotten a little tighter towards focusing on business services, healthcare, and government services, but the basic approach is really still the same.
And how many companies do you look at any one time? And maybe you can talk a little bit about how you even get an opportunity to look at these companies. Are they flocking to you, or do you seek out certain opportunities as well?
It's really a combination. We look at probably about 500 investment opportunities a year, of which we might invest in two or three, so it's a pretty rigorous screening process. The way we find these opportunities is a combination of both our reaching out to the many relationships we've developed in the community over the last 25-plus years, plus proactive reaching out to interesting companies that we read about or otherwise come across, as well as folks coming directly to us either on their own or with the help of an advisor, investment banker, or other intermediary to solicit our interest in potentially investing in their company. So it's really a mix of both outbound and inbound sourcing of opportunities. And the good news is that after 25-plus years of kind of looking for the similar characteristics, we're pretty good at being able to know which things are a fit for us. And by no means would I ever say that, you know, our criteria for what we're interested in investing in are the only criteria on which you could have a successful private equity firm. There are certainly lots of different approaches within our industry, but the one that we have is one that has worked for us for a long time, and so we believe in it, and we tend to stick with it.
Well, looking at your track record, it certainly seems like you've got the criteria and the metrics in place, and you know, really evaluating from those 500 companies down to two is pretty rigorous. And
you know, it has paid off. The focus on organic growth is something, you know, companies that are fundamentally selling differentiated solutions to customers and doing more of that every year has paid off, particularly during these soft economic times. We've seen our portfolio companies dramatically outperform their peers because they are in industries that are growing, notwithstanding the downturn, and because our management teams have been able to focus on executing and growing their businesses without the distractions of high levels of debt.
So, Murray, since our show topic is branding, let me dig into that a little bit more here. In our experience at Rikus Baird and the opportunity of working with hundreds of companies over the years, we found that a strong brand can actually become a business driver. But I'd like to get your viewpoint on that comment.
It's absolutely true, Ryan. It really is. You know, differentiation of a company's offering is really a key element in both our assessment of the company's potential and ultimately of the company creating business value and making our investment successful. And branding is a powerful way to create differentiation. You know, there are lots of examples in the consumer markets. One that I always cite is Gatorade versus Powerade. You know, it's the same stuff, but Gatorade owns that marketplace. It's the brand. Yeah, I think it's intrinsically part of human nature to prefer branded products that folks are comfortable with. There's just something about our, you know, we're not robots. We're not entirely analytical creatures measuring cost benefit and label nutrients against each other. We're humans with emotions, and branding captures that emotional element of who we are. And I can just even give you an example from our portfolio that'd
be perfect.
A few years ago, we repositioned a company that both in its marketplace of current and potential customers, and even in the eyes of its own employees, from being a provider of commodity solutions that were sold to the purchasing department of its corporate customers, to being a provider of highly engineered, high intellect content, high precision solutions that were sold to the corporate client's R&D staff. The actual products and services they were providing were the same. It's just different branding. And we created a whole lot of value for the shareholders that way, because the way both the marketplace and then ultimately the company that acquired our portfolio company viewed us was transformed because how we told the story. So I absolutely guarantee you that branding is a powerful way to create business value.
Is that fairly common in your approach of, you know, taking a company that's doing well, it meets your criteria, but obviously you see the future potential, and then you really take that to the next level by putting further clarity around that differentiated solution, as you describe it?
It's definitely true that that's one of the ways that we work with our portfolio companies, and I think it's actually fairly common that we've observed that our portfolio companies, even though they have $25 to $100 million in revenue at the time we invest in them, which makes them, you know, fairly sizable companies and successful and profitable, they typically have not done a great job in positioning themselves and branding themselves. And the explanation, I think, that covers that is that the entrepreneurs who have built these businesses are too busy with the day-to-day aspects of building a business from zero to, let's say, $50 million in revenue to have the time available to think strategically about how to tell their story. They found a customer, then they found another customer by word of mouth, and it keeps going, and they're just busy trying to make sure that they check everything off the list every day. It's very hard for them to step back and say, okay, what is our value proposition? How do we differentiate ourselves? How should we tell the story? And, you know, we strongly encourage our portfolio companies to use resources like your firm to identify, clarify, focus, and present to the world their story in a differentiated way. I think it's amazing how much value that can add, and you can be successful without a sharp focus on that, but you can be a lot more successful with a sharp focus on it.
Well, how do you go about that process of actually evaluating the potential of a brand when you're considering a new portfolio company?
What we will typically do is study the marketplace. And, you know, prior to making the investment, we will assess the competitive landscape, conduct reference calls with current customers, study research reports prepared by industry analysts, and sometimes even hire a market research firm to contact participants in the marketplace on a no-names basis to get direct feedback. And all of that provides background context for us to sort of say, okay, now we see the landscape. Now where's the piece of turf that this company can carve out as uniquely its piece of turf? And then typically the CEO will intuitively kind of know what the company does well and why it wins, but they haven't really thought of how to tailor their entire go-to-market plan around that proposition, that brand.
Interesting. So does an organization that have their brand or their value proposition well-defined, or if they don't but you see the opportunity, does that have any impact in weighing on the multiple that you might be able to get out of a company?
Absolutely. You know, while ultimately the assessment of valuation on our part, and I think even to some degree by companies that acquire our portfolio companies, is largely driven by financial metrics, what's happening is the branding success drives the financial metrics that then drive the valuation. Because if you have a strong brand, you will typically see above average gross margin percentages. Brands typically translate into pricing power, which means that instead of selling at commodity prices with low gross margin percentages, you're selling at premium prices with higher gross margin percentages, again, all relative to your peer group. I mean, some industries, the norm, the gross margin percentage norm average might be 20%, and if you're getting 27%, that's a pretty amazing premium. Others, the norm might be 35, and you know you need to be getting mid-40s to be truly impressively branded. But the branding translates into above normal gross margins. And it's really the gross margin line, because the SG&A is not really a branding necessarily issue. It's really, you can really see that people are willing to pay a premium for your product compared to your competitors. And so that's how branding manifests on the financial statements and ultimately translates into value. And I think it also shows up in revenue growth as well, because if you have a strongly differentiated solution, you tend to be growing well.
I couldn't agree more with you. It's interesting to hear your perspective. I love the comment, brands translate into pricing power. That's beautiful.
You absolutely see it. Well, I mean, you know, you can succeed by trying to become the low-cost commodity provider of something, and there certainly are a few stories out there of companies that have managed to do that, but that's certainly not the approach to success that we're looking to invest in, and I think it's the less common approach to success, because it's sort of a race to the bottom as far as who can keep the cost lower and lower. The preferred approach is really to try to capture the higher end of the market where the margins are better because you have branding and differentiation.
Mm-hmm. And you can build upon that.
Yeah.
In some countries, brand value is actually a line item on the balance sheet. How do you go about placing a value on the brand? Do you look at it, the brand, as an extension of goodwill, or because it can be a soft perspective on it, or do you actually try to put a value on it? I'd love to get your viewpoint on that.
Sure. I think what happens is, because we're thinking of valuation off of earning power, you know, ability to generate EBITDA or free cash flow or whatever term you want to use for it. And so we're less focused on the balance sheet aspect of it. And so our emphasis really is looking at those higher than average gross margin percentages, and that ultimately translates into higher than average EBITDA margin percentages, which translates into both a higher multiple and a higher absolute amount of dollars of value. And so, you know, when we see companies, if you had two identical companies in the same marketplace, one with what I'll call industry average gross margin percentage and the other with consistently above average gross margin percentage, and we do look into those things, we would apply a higher multiple to the one with the higher margin percentage, figuring that that track record is consistent evidence that they have pricing power. And of course, we would look into why that is and make sure we understood that it wasn't just a fluke, that there was really a reason there was a brand there, and that's why some of our market research would reveal that issue. But there's no doubt that if you can consistently command premium margins, you get a higher multiple.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly makes sense. So we often get hired to help a company define their value proposition or their brand, and we like to call that a promise of distinction, which really creates clear definition and differentiation from the competition. And yet when we go through the process and look at the market, the trends, the competition, the unique attributes of the organization, what opportunities they truly have in the marketplace, we often help then a company further define its future place, its future vision. In fact, we try to package it up into purpose, vision, and mission and values. And sometimes those get kind of buried in, yeah, we checked the box, we got that done. But in many cases, we find that when they're done well and the executive team clearly gets behind them, they can become a strong driving force to unite and guide an internal culture, giving people a clear understanding of where the organization's going and their role in helping it get there and really, you know, uniting an organization. I'd love to get your viewpoint on these type of statements. Do you see them being effective if they're done right?
Absolutely. You know, I do believe that there's something amazingly impressive. We don't see it very often, but when we do see it, it is really impressive. When a CEO comes in to talk about his or her business and says, this is our goal, and goes through in what I'll call tiers of progressively more detailed description of what they do. So they start with the basically one sentence, you know, this is why we're here. This is what, then maybe three sentences, this is where the business is going. And then, in, as I say, tiers of progressively more detailed description talk about how they actually execute on that. In contrast, when somebody comes in and just starts talking kind of what I'll call loosely about their business. Yeah, we do these things and we have some customers and, you know, this is kind of where we're hoping things might happen. And that is a much less impressive, less focused leader and correspondingly less impressive business than the person who comes in and has a well-defined hierarchy of kind of, it's almost like an outline kind of thing with progressive levels of greater detail. And that's really this purpose, vision, mission, and values.
On a related note, we have found over the years that no matter how good a corporate strategy is, it comes down to the people inside the organization to really deliver it. And therefore, culture is, in often cases, more important than strategy. How do you look at and evaluate an organization's culture when you're considering a portfolio company?
Culture is especially critical in the kinds of businesses that we invest in because most of our businesses are in the services sector, business services, healthcare, and government services. And so they're really their only asset is their people. And while you'll often hear folks wonder about how you can invest in a business where, quote, the assets walk out the door every night, mm-hmm. It's in fact we've been, I think, leaders in making those kinds of investments because we understand that in those situations, if you have a strong, distinctive culture, you actually have assets that are more valuable than the traditional tangible assets of machines and equipment and factories and that sort of thing that folks are used to thinking about. That a place where people really love to come to work every day is an incredibly valuable organization. And so culture is what it's all about in these high intellect people businesses that we invest in, because the kinds of folks who work there have choices in their employment. They're talented people with in-demand skills. And so you really need to excite them about the opportunity that they're coming into every day. And it's, there's no, I don't think there's any scientific way of measuring culture, but I think that's one of the advantages of having been in our business for 25 plus years and having invested in dozens of people-based businesses over that time that we can feel it. When we talk to people, when we walk around an organization, we can really get a sense of whether they've got that magic culture. Now, you can also look at metrics like employee turnover, and that'll give you a quantitative feel on it. But again, there's enough intuition that allows you to tell whether the right stuff is there.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to measure, but when you get the culture going in the right direction, it becomes a very powerful component to success.
Absolutely. All of our portfolio companies, I think, have great culture. One that comes to mind based right here in Irvine is called CyberCoders, and they've been recognized as among the best places to work here in Orange County and gotten other similar recognition because they really have struck an ideal balance between both accountability and pay for performance on the one hand, which you need to have because it's a business, not a charity, and on the other hand, having it be a fun, engaging, collaborative, exciting place to come to work every day.
Yeah, that punch the clock 8 to 5 program just doesn't work anymore, does it?
Yeah, I mean, you might be able to do it when your employees are what I'll call fungible, where they're almost, you know, they're manufacturing workers where you can just go to the temp agency and say, I need another 4, I need another 2 today. But if your workers are IT professionals, marketing professionals, creative website developers, or anything like that, those people are all unique and not easily replaceable, and you really need to remember that when you figure out how to treat them.
Murray, in your view, who in the organization is responsible for the brand? Is it the guy at the top, the CEO, the executive team, or is it the marketing executive?
It's the CEO. As they say, tone starts at the top, and one of the CEO's key strategic responsibilities is to define the company's direction, which really starts with what is the company's differentiated value proposition and hence its brand. And all these issues, not only of branding, but even the issues of culture that we were just talking about a moment ago, really are set by the CEO. Everyone takes their cue on that from the CEO, and it's really critical, and that's why evaluating the CEO is probably the number one assessment that we do in the course of our consideration of a potential investment.
Well, it makes sense. It all started at the top, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, Murray, you've been fantastic. Here are a few different key takeaways that I picked up from our talk this morning. You spoke about the fundamentals of success really haven't changed over the years. It really all does begin with a differentiated solution that becomes the foundation and really prepares you for the future. Certainly, an executive or CEO that comes in with a clear vision, that's a very powerful and motivating opportunity to get their team aligned and to give you clarity on where the business could go. And yet you find that most of these companies in the $25 to $100 million range have been so entrepreneurial and they've been running the business but not necessarily spending enough time on clarifying their value proposition or telling the story of where their business could go. And yet you find that maybe together with your guidance that you have the opportunity to build these companies and develop their brands. And love your quote, the brand's straight, a well-defined brand translates into pricing power. I mean, a greater profit margin. I mean, it's just a beautiful thought. And then you back it up with this idea around culture and, you know, getting a team united around a common vision and a working environment and style creates a sustainable solution to move the business forward. Anything you'd like to share today? I love your comments, and we could spend the next hour together, but what else do you have that might be of interest?
I think that was a great summary, Ryan. I think I would just remind folks that branding is a very powerful tool to create shareholder value, and I would encourage CEOs to work on developing and optimizing their brand, and also encourage them to get an expert like Rikus Baird to help them. You know, the analogy I would use is that just like climbers on Mount Everest require a Sherpa in order to successfully summit the mountain, and no one even attempts it without one or more Sherpas, CEOs that are trying to maximize their brand need good folks like you and your teammates Brian, to create that value. And so I would leave that with folks as kind of my summary.
Well, Murray, thank you. Thank you for being a guest on Branding Business. If our listeners have any questions of you, how would they reach you? Website, email, phone number?
Sure. You can learn more about our firm, Reardon, Lewis & Hayden, at www.rlhequity.com. My email is mruden, that's M-R-U-D as in David, I-N as in Nancy, at rlhequity.com. And the phone number here is 949-428-2200.
Perfect. Murray, thank you again.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Ryan. Great chat with you.
Take care.
Okay, you too.
Well, folks, you've been listening to Branding Business with Rikus Baird. To learn more about our show or read our blogs, please visit brandingbusiness.com.
You've been listening to Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. To hear more, simply visit our website, brandingbusiness.com, or tune in next week to learn how you, too, can build your brand and move your business forward. Brought to you by Rikus Baird.